Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, do you know who Barry Ritholtz is?
Yeah, a little bit.
Kind of a big deal here. He's been around for a while. He's a money manager, a Bloomberg opinion columnist, and he's also a fellow podcast host. His podcast, Masters in Business, is literally a crash course in business with some of the biggest names in everything from finance to banking to managing money.
Yeah, absolutely. He's one of the most interesting people. He runs an advisor shop that is cutting edge in a couple ways.
What's it called?
Ritholtz Wealth Management. You know, I'm on Twitter and a lot of those guys are very popular. Their blog posts are really great. And Barry is very honest and brutally honest. And he's not afraid to answer any question, even if it's about advisor fees and whatnot. And I've seen him operate on Twitter and he'll take on anybody, he'll answer anything. He's just very vocal. And obviously, he's used to interviewing people. So I thought it'd be interesting to interview him. And I know he's a big ETF user.
That's the cool part, because he manages a lot of money, he and his team. And he has some really important views about ETFs.
Yeah, when someone goes out and says ETFs are the devil, he tends to be on the other side of that. And I've noticed that because he's using them. I mean, he has real people's money in ETFs. So he better believe they work and they're good. So we asked him about ETFs, passive. He uses some active, why he's not persuaded by thematic ETFs, even if he likes the industry. I thought that was interesting. And also just this low-cost migration that advisors are loving in the asset management side, but hasn't quite hit the advisor side. And that's a third rail issue, but he took it on and he was not afraid to talk about.
Oh, he wasn't afraid to talk about anything. We hit on, I think, God, portfolio management,
Trump.
ETFs, Trump, trade, everything.
And, you know, when you talk about being honest about those things, he really is that way in his columns and on Twitter. And so are the people he works with. So we asked them, you know, as an advisor with clients, has that helped and has it ever hurt? I thought that was interesting.
So what are we going to call this episode?
Because we actually have so much material. It's like a double album.
It's a double podcast.
So
the White Album.
I have one even better. Use Your Disillusion 1 and 2.
Oh, I like that.
And I say that because Barry talks about disillusion being the reason a lot of money has shifted over to passive in the past 10 years.
Sidebar, Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion 1 or 2, which is your preferred?
I can't remember. Probably the one with Don't Cry. That's probably my favorite song from that whole thing. But there's a, I don't know, half of it is good. The other half
I'm
I could live without.
I'm a big fan of Estranged. Estranged was on number 2. That was a great one. This week on Trillions, Use Your Disillusion 1 and 2 with Barry Effin Ritholtz.
Barry Effin Ritholtz, go.
How did you become who you are?
So I'll share a deep, dark secret with you guys. And nobody believes me when I say this, but it's really true. A lot of what I do is just because I'm entertaining myself. So Daniel Boorstin is the Librarian of Congress, former Librarian of Congress, and he famously once said, I write to figure out what I think, and besides that hour, all the bars are closed, unquote. And that's really true. You don't understand your own thought process. You don't know what you really think until you go through the entire process of putting it on paper, figuring it out. Here's my intro. Here are my supporting points. Here's my conclusion. We have a very muddled internal dialogue. Most people are not crystal clear about their viewpoints and their positions. It's why people are so easily influenced. They don't really know what they believe. There's a handful of things that they're probably pretty deeply ensconced in, their personal spirituality, their religion, some of their ethics. However, a lot of what they think they believe is very squishy and so often ill-defined. So writing really helps you figure that out. And what started with the blog was frustration with the 90s and 2000s media, which I thought the financial media was pretty mediocre and in a lot of ways, punctuated with excellence, but a lot of really terrible stuff. So at most major newspapers, someone would get hired for the economics beat because it was terrible. And they would send them to, all right, you're going to go to the Treasury and you're going to get this report. This comes out at 8 o'clock. And then you know, on Friday, you're going to, first Friday of the month, you're going to go do non-farm payroll at the Labor Department. And they used to actually go to these places and they would write these terrible things about what happened. Most people who are language oriented don't frequently have the math skills to keep up with that. And they don't understand things like causation, and they don't understand. So you ended up with these things that most of the time don't matter, but occasionally are important and were frequently wrong. And so the entire blog, the big picture, began as a pushback to that. Just by, I would read something and it would frustrate me because I knew it was either wrong or, to the average investor, misleading. And the same thing was true with the podcast. I used to pull my hair out of my head. There would be some fantastic person on Choose Your Poison, Bloomberg TV or CNBC or Fox Business or Fox News before they had Fox Business or CNN Business. And they would do this terrible interview. What's your favorite stock? Where's the Dow going to be in a year? Hey, when is the Fed going to cut rates or raise rates? And I'm like, wait, this guy is brilliant. He wrote the seminal white paper on fill in the blank. Who is he? How did he get that way? So the podcast, if the blog was pushed back to financial media, the podcast, which just celebrated its fourth anniversary.
Congratulations. Is that is that like the Wood anniversary?
I don't know. It's 200 plus interviews, many of which last 12, 18 hours, things like that. And it's the podcast was pushed back to the electronic media's refusal to have, and I shouldn't say refusal, the rarity of a very good interview with people who are intelligent and accomplished and have a unique perspective and have something to say. Who cares what their favorite stock is? They walk out of the building, it's already stale. Ask them something that's evergreen and important.
How did you get into managing money?
So I started as a trader a few decades ago, and that was a ton of fun. You make a lot of money. Some months you lose a lot of money, but it was really, really interesting. And eventually I came to the conclusion that it was fairly, as far as I was concerned, the compensation ended up being fairly random. But most fascinating to me was the guys on the desk around me. And it was back then it was all guys. And this person's making money this month and this person isn't. And then you flip it. And that sent me down a rabbit hole of why performance exists and how people, some people do well and some people don't. And the entire behavioral finance rabbit hole opened up to me in the mid 90s. But I went from there to research. I became an assistant to a technology strategist at a firm that no longer exists. It was ended up being bought by Oppenheimer, and then eventually became a market strategist. And so the first 20 years of my career, I said, turn down money. Listen, I can't compromise the objectivity I have in doing my research, or so I foolishly thought.
That's what Eric says.
But eventually, it became clear to me that when I would refer people to other, oh, this guy, you want muni bonds? Go talk to him. Oh, you want this? It dawned on me one day when I referred somebody to a muni bond specialist, the person came back to me and said, so tell me about this private placement they're talking about. And I suddenly had a tremendous insight. Oh, my God, I have massive reputational liability and probably legal liability if I send someone, not getting paid for it, never asking for a dime, but thinking I'm doing the right thing by sending people to. And at that point, it was like, all right, that's it. I'm done making those sort of idiotic risk decisions, forwarding people to other people. Congratulations, you're the first client of the Ritholtz Group. And that's how that began. And that was just about a decade.
You still have that first client?
Yes, still do.
And how many clients do you have total?
I want to say we work with about 500 families, a little under, and we're up to about $900 million. We're just shy of a billion, and we're just shy of 5 years.
Congratulations.
Which will, September 15th is our
champagne party
anniversary. Can I tell you something? We discussed that internally in the office and decided it was a bad look.
Mm.
And instead, I know this sounds like
I can't wait.
Hokey and self-serving. We decided that the whole New York office is going to go volunteer somewhere on that anniversary. I know that it sounds artificial, but it really isn't because...
No, I love that.
This industry is somewhat notorious for a lot of back padding, and we're all guilty of it. And we would like to avoid that sort of look.
All right, so Barry, we invited you on this podcast, which is about ETFs, because I've seen you write about ETFs. You speak at many of the ETF conferences. Mm-hmm. You've talked about investing in them. Just talk about, you know, as an advisor, what ETFs have done for your business and how you use them.
Sure. So there are a couple of really obvious, simple advantages of ETFs. Perhaps first and foremost is the tax structure is vastly superior to most other things. And that's number one. Number two, with ETFs, if you're dealing, we set up an online, this is already a couple of years old, we set up an online, I hate the term robo-advisor, but an automated solution that is low touch, low cost, and it trades essentially commission free at TD using all of these ETFs from various names like Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street and what have you. And that circle of commission free stuff is always changing, but we don't change the portfolio to reflect it. Regardless, you can set up a well-diversified portfolio, not with $2 million, not with $200,000, but with, you know, $20,000. That wasn't possible pre-ETFs. It didn't make sense to buy $5,000 worth of a mutual fund, given the costs and the price breaks and what have you, but you can do that with ETFs. When it comes time to rebalance or what have you, you can make those sort of changes very easily.
And what's your ETF index fund active mutual fund balance in a typical portfolio or in that $900 million in firm assets? How's that allocated roughly percentage-wise?
So I don't want to misspeak because you asked three things. So let me give you a broad overview and then we'll drill down. So we typically believe in a broad, globally diversified, low-cost asset allocation model. And we use dimensional funds, Vanguard, a Wisdom Tree fund, basically all the names you would know. And you don't need a million funds to be really diversified. Between 10 and 15 gives you pretty much the entire world, 10 and 15 holdings. Some of the portfolios we have are all ETFs. We have a tactical portfolio we use, which isn't the typical tactical portfolio. It exists. It's rules driven. It's pretty basic quantitative strategy. But the idea is if 20% of your holdings is in a portfolio that gets out of the way for the fat part of a 30 or 40% market collapse, then you could leave your real money alone and not try and market time. Not that this market times, but it's basically a trend following system. And the idea is if the market really has a wild hiccup, well, your average 70% stock, 30% bond portfolio with a 20% slug in the tactical, it ends up looking like 50-50. And so if you can't withstand a 20% drawdown in your portfolio, which is what a 50-50 portfolio should do in a 40% crash, then you shouldn't be in equities.
What are you telling clients now?
That this is the fat part of the economic cycle, that we're hitting on all cylinders, that when you come out of an economic crisis, out of a financial credit crisis, that you tend to have a long, slow recovery. By the way, this isn't us saying this in 2018. I've been writing this on Bloomberg and elsewhere for, you know, pretty much the whole run. You look at the research from Reinhart and Rogoff, it's pretty clear. Weak GDP, weak consumer spending, soft job creation, soft wage gains, weak home price appreciation is what typically describes the post-credit crisis recoveries. This has been playing out with some variables pretty close to that script, which implies that the cycle will go much longer than most people believe. I've been reading people call for a recession, I don't know, just about twice a year for the past 10 years. It's hard to see anything on the immediate horizon that is a threat. The Fed is tightening, but they're tightening from very low levels with very low, small amounts of inflation. Now, all these can change. Maybe the tariffs push through a lot of inflation. Maybe some other saber rattling causes a problem. So typically, an external shock to a strong economic recovery or a strong economic cycle doesn't really affect it. But when you have an economy that's starting to falter, it doesn't take much of a shove to send it sprawling. So far, the economy has been very robust and has withstood a series of, I'm not going to be politically correct, I'm just going to say a series of ill-thought-out economic actions by this administration that in a weaker economy would have caused a recession. They're just fortunate that they inherited a very strong economy. Otherwise, we would be looking at something far less. I would be far less sanguine about what was going on in D.C. if I wasn't confident enough that the economy was robust.
There's a lot of people, you talk about this sort of economic bull market that we've been seeing for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of chatter out there, and you've heard it, you've actually written about it, that, oh, it's this Russian to passive that's just blindly lifting all these stocks, and look out, when the passive bubble pops, everybody is going to be running back to active. What's your take on all this? As somebody who uses passive, does any of that break through to you?
Right. Well, we use passive and active. I think the bulk of most people's portfolio should be mostly passive, and I think if they want to throw an overlay of value or small cap or whatever, that's perfectly fine. The passive indexing versus active management debate has been frighteningly ignorant, shockingly self-serving. Some of the stupidest crap I've ever read about finance has come out of it. Indexing is Marxism. Do you remember that nonsense mm-hmm. a couple
yeah.
of years ago?
Sanford Bernstein, of course. It's
a bubble that's going to crash everything. How is indexing a bubble? So let's put this into context. First, indexing began 40 years ago. And despite the obvious advantages of low cost, low taxes, low turnover, no specific benchmark other than the benchmark, the S&P 500, the pursuit of alpha typically leads to not even achieving beta. So the intellectual underpinnings of this have been around for literally decades. It was only in the past 10 years that this blew up. And so when you look at the context of this, why? Why did this blow up? And I'll give you five reasons, and I think this helps explain why it's not a bubble, it's not Marxism, it's not the end of capitalism. It's, first of all, you go back to the late 90s, the early 2000s, scandal after scandal after scandal, the IPO spinning scandal, the analyst scandals, the accounting scandals, one after another after another. That's before we get to Bernie Madoff and all the Ponzi schemes and everything else. And then the dot-com collapse. I think at a certain point, the mom-and-pop investor says, you know, I've played this game, and it doesn't seem to work for me. Right? That's before high-frequency trading made individuals feel like the market was skewed against them. But as we say in our office, the solution to high-frequency trading is low-frequency trading. Mm-hmm. If you're not an active trader, that doesn't affect you. So that's number one. Number two, you had a series of giant market crashes. The dot-com collapse, then the housing collapse, then the great financial crisis, then the commodities collapse. It seems wherever investors went hunting for alpha, they got their heads handed to them. And at a certain point, the Main Street investor says, you know what? Screw you guys. I'm taking my ball and going home. And so for them, who have to be invested if they want to retire, it made sense to say, I'm not going to pay commissions. I'm going to pay an $8 fee to buy an index at TD or Schwab or wherever.
Or go robo.
You know, I've been promised this outperformance, but when you actually do the math, the outperformance isn't there. The brokers end up capturing the lion's share of whatever upside there is. If you, Jim Chanos said on Masters in Business, you know, when he started his hedge fund 30 years ago, there were 300 guys creating alpha, all guys back then. Now there's 11,000 funds, and it's the same 300 people creating alpha. So unless you're fortunate enough to be in one of those funds, you're paying a lot for underperformance. And I think, again, the public has kind of figured out they're not in those funds. They don't have access to it. And then the fourth, and I think the most important thing is behavioral finance has become so ubiquitous and so well understood that the average person says, you know, I'm full of my own biases and I'm emotional and I don't necessarily have the discipline to do this the right way. So they've begun to recognize, rather than try and play that game, I'm just going to buy an index and see in 40 years.
Well, this is all what's fueled why we have a podcast called Trillions About ETFs, right?
Like, 100%.
Why do people even need advisors? Why not just do the robo thing that you have or anybody else's robo?
So there's three-part answer to that. First, some people don't even need robo-advisors. They can do it themselves. I spoke years ago at an AAII event, and this wife comes up to me with her husband in tow and says, "Tell my husband he's an idiot." So I turn to the guy and say, "Sir, you're an idiot. Now that I've called your husband an idiot, why do you think he's an idiot?" And she says, "He keeps buying all these stocks that are collapsing." I go, "Stocks like Lehman and AIG?" Or, "No, he bought Disney when it fell, and he bought JP Morgan." "Ma'am, if he has the..." I go, "Are you panicking and selling?" He goes, "No, I buy one at here. I do one entry when it falls X percent. I do a second entry here. I only buy quality companies without a lot of debt and a lot of the..." "Ma'am..." He's not an idiot. I go, right. He's doing fine. Now, you need to be disciplined. You need to be thoughtful. You need to spend a lot of time. The person had been retired since his mid-50s. He loves this. And he goes, "I've beaten the market 4 out of the past 7 years," or something like that. "And when you missed," he goes, "I was right there." "Oh, okay." So I said to the wife, "Ma'am, I don't know what to tell you. He's doing a good job." So that's one person. But that's not the average investor. The average investor doesn't have the time, doesn't have the discipline, doesn't have the emotional balance to not get sucked in to the vortex when everything gets hairy and things are flying over your head and everything on the news is the world is ending. Some group of people, the robo-advisors are perfectly valid for. "Listen, I want a simple portfolio. I don't care what you have to say. I don't want to speak to you. Once a quarter, send me an update, and once a year, tell me if I'm on target for my plan."
I mean, doesn't that actually breed good behavior, though?
One would think. But again, that's not the average investor. The average investor, whenever you do a survey asking people what their risk tolerance is, what you get is not their risk tolerance. What you get is how the market behaved over the prior 90 days. If the market's falling, they're really conservative, and they don't want to take a lot of risk. When the market's screaming higher, "Listen, I'm aggressive and I can withstand." So it doesn't tell you anything. So you really have to be aware of what people say isn't very often what they do. And then there's another group of people who are running businesses or owning companies or very busy in a professional career, and they know they don't have the time or energy or discipline or focus. And besides, they would rather spend their time and energy on their own business than dealing with their own 401k, their employees' 401k, setting stuff up for the kids. Some people have generational wealth issues. Some people want to give money to philanthropy. Some people want to make sure that when they sell a business that they don't max out their taxes. There's a ton of things that require some expertise. And that's the typical advisor client that gets what they pay for. You know, if someone says, "Listen, just buy me an S&P 500, why would those people pay, you know, an advisor for that? They don't need that. The issue becomes the complexity which is out there, the discipline to manage your own behavior, and what you need in terms of various services.
Real quick sidebar, there's a pot ETF, there's a cybersecurity ETF, robotics.
Right.
These theme ETFs have risen a little bit. A lot of people blow them off. But a lot of the stocks they hold are young. They won't be in the big indexes for a while that most people own. Is there a case for them? Do you ever get tempted by some of these more speculative areas?
Yes, there's a case for them. No, I'm never tempted by them.
But like, you know how Google had the big earnings recently?
Yes.
And then everybody on Twitter does this thing where they quote people who said Google's not going anywhere.
Right.
I feel like those are the same people who poo-poo like a pot ETF because they're like, oh, it's a joke.
I don't think it's a joke.
Right. But
it's just speculation.
Correct. But if Google was sort of waved off back then or looked at as maybe high-flying or speculative, shouldn't things that are speculative today be taken more seriously to get your claws into that young industry or young stock as opposed to waiting till it's an adult and finally makes it into the S&P 500?
Alex, I'll take survivorship bias for 100, please. So you're telling me about Google today, but you're not mentioning Pets.com or Cosmo or any of the other thousands of pieces of crap that came and go. Remember, Google was like the 26th search engine. I was a beta tester for Google back in the 18th century, and I remember playing with it for a day and sending an email to the person who invited me. This is interesting. How can I invest in your company?
Was that like a Yahoo.com email?
I don't even remember. No, it was AOL.
AOL, okay.
Worse. It was dial-up.
On the dial-up.
Right. That crazy era. So let's separate the pot ETFs from, and a buddy of mine runs a cannabinoid wellness and health hedge fund.
Describe buddy.
This is somebody, Todd Harrison. This is somebody I'm friendly with. Never indulged in any leafy material with him. But he's a person whose office was right near the World Trade Center during 9/11, had horrific survivorship guilt. They put him on the usual opioids and depressants. He hated what it did to him. He said, I'm not who I used to be. Eventually found his way to some legal medical, like, there have been medical marijuana legal in New York for really, really specific diseases. Mm-hmm. It's not like quote-unquote medical marijuana when it was in California where, hey, dude, I'm having a hard time sleeping. Oh, here's some weed. That is not what New York was. And look at what's taking place state by state. Does anybody doubt that 50 years from now, regular marijuana is sold over the counter like beer? How about 20 years from now? How about 10 years from now? At a certain point, it's clear we can't incarcerate millions of people for weed and pay millions of dollars, billions of dollars to drug companies for things that may or may not work. Oh, and thanks for the opioid
Jeff
epidemic.
Sessions would like to speak with you now.
You know, Jeff right, Sessions, so this whole crew is a temporary setback to the relentless right. march forward of progress, not just politically, technologically, sociologically.
So you sound like you understand the pot industry, the growth, and all this. This is a great example.
I'm high right now. No,
high on life. I can say it. But it's a good example because we do talk about these ETFs in the show a lot. But as an investor, say you're out there.
WEED, is that the one?
Yeah, but say you're listening out there. MJ is the ticker. It's okay. A diversified basket of pot stocks.
Mary Jane? Very
yes.
cute.
It could have been better, but
I think weed. Good. How does nobody have weed? It must be Orkin or something.
Well, I think the issuers didn't want to go too far and like really irk the SEC
Cowards.
By like doing a touchdown dance with the ticker. But I digress.
The ticker makes a big difference.
But here's a case where you know the industry. You kind of sound like you're.
I'm intrigued by it, but
as an investor, what stops you from trying to get an early foothold in using, say, a diversified basket like MJ?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, I have. You know, the old joke is the second mouse gets the cheese. The settlers, the early settlers are the ones with the arrows in their back. I don't
That's
know.
That's pretty good.
I don't know if MJ.
That's like Ben Franklin type stuff right there.
Right. So the question, we mentioned Google, right? So is this the first group of stocks? Is this the second group? Like how many dog pile and go and what were some of the other
right.
Alta Vista, how many of these other mediocre search engines do we have to go through before Google comes along, executes better, has a broader vision, can do all
gotcha.
These things they need to do? So maybe MJ is a home run, or
right.
maybe it's a speculative piece of crap that goes nowhere. I have no way to tell that.
So you have an odd advantage to some extent because of being media savvy.
Okay.
Your whole team is just, you guys are especially candid and entertaining. I mean, I think you're at the tip of the spear in that regards. Then at the back end, there's these asset managers and advisors. Mm-hmm. We'll call them traditional.
Sure.
You never hear from them. If you do, you get like a research report that's been vetted by 15 lawyers.
Right.
It feels late.
And milquetoast.
Yeah. You know what I mean. Is this Twitter and this sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Candidness?
Social media?
Yeah.
Or?
Is this the future, or do you think it will sort of live over here in a more compartmentalized, and the tradition will stay? Because they do have a ton of assets.
Right.
Or is it all going to slowly switch over where you fear the Fidelity portfolio manager, debating you over Jeff Sessions on Twitter?
So the answer to that is yes and no. I don't see Fidelity, Vanguard, BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Schwab. I don't see them as occupying the space we do. Now, they all have started blogs of some sort. Many of them have podcasts. Go down the list of some of the stuff that we do, some of the media we do. But, you know, keep in mind, you have to recognize the history of this. The blog started because in the 80s, you had to have gone to the right school. You had to work for the right firm. Otherwise, you're not getting on TV. You're not getting on radio. And so there were gatekeepers and walls, and the rest of us were sort of voiceless. That began to change with thestreet.com was sort of and the Yahoo message boards. There was a broad democratization of media and discussion and debate.
Sure.
About investing. The problem is Yahoo message boards were filled with fake news. That was really fake news. Longs were saying things that were wrong. Shorts were saying things that were wrong. And everybody, the search for the truth was fought. And the old expression is a lie gets halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes. So what eventually that evolved into was, and I described the signal to loss ratio in a number of columns over the years. I've written about this a lot. But at a certain point, people no longer read mastheads. They read specific writers. So at the Wall Street Journal, it's Spencer Jacob. It used to be Jesse Eisinger. He's now at ProPublica. At Slate and elsewhere, it's Henry Graeber and it's Dan Gross. I mean, I give you a list of 100 people. At Bloomberg, there are 100 people I follow. So what started happening is the precursor to social media began when, if you're paying attention, you start to notice, hey, this person's right a whole lot more than they're wrong. I'm going to pay attention to what they say. And that eventually has become, so from Yahoo message boards to thestreet.com to really cherry picking the best writers to social media, people kind of figured out that it's not a monolith, that you can pick out writers who are better than others, who have something to... I mean, everything Morgan Housel writes, I devour, because he's spectacular. If you're interested in Donald Trump, then you must read every column that Tim O'Brien writes, because he has insights that nobody else, having been sued by Trump...
And seeing documents.
This brings up a good question, which is, have you ever had a client upset about something you tweeted, maybe political or whatnot? Does that ever bite you?
It does, but, I wish I could say we were so brilliant that this whole thing is by design, but it's not. So the typical Wall Street advisor is very much right of center, not even right-leaning. They tend to be politically and financially conservative. I don't know why. It just kind of has happened over the years. Maybe that's a result of tax policy. I'm guessing. But, I think of myself as fiscally conservative and socially progressive with a libertarian streak. That means, by the way, I love harassing my libertarian friends who I accuse of being cowardly hypocrites. So wait, the government can't get involved in euthanasia or weed, but they can get involved in birth control and abortion rights. You have to be intellectually consistent.
Let's say you write that, and does a libertarian client ever call and say, Barry, come on, man, stop.
So we've had conversations with people.
Off.
We've had conversations with people who have said, gee, we wish you wouldn't weigh in. So let me back up a little bit. So we do a monthly letter or a quarterly letter, and when occasionally special events happens, we'll do it. The night before the election in 2016, I write my quarterly letter, and I leave the last paragraph blank because I know enough about random outcomes that I know I don't know what the final results will be, and the polls had been really close. But the basic premise of the column was the monthly letter was, presidents get way too much credit for when things go right and way too much blame for when things go wrong. And you really have to go out of your way to screw up royally for a president to impact a market. And so, gee, you could look at some of the stuff Nixon did between Watergate and some of the other and Vietnam. You could look at George W. You could look at Carter. You could see a number of presidents who their worst decisions probably pressured the stock market. On the other hand, you know, a rip-roaring market doesn't care. 82 to 2000, you know, Clinton got impeached. The market laughed and it kept going. The same thing with Bush. Bush cut taxes. He did this, he did that, and the market imploded. So it's almost as if the markets don't care about this, which is a theme. But the last paragraph of the letter was, which I wrote the next morning, was, hey, many of you have enjoyed tremendous gains since the market bottomed in March 2009, and many of you have expressed concerns about things that all good libertarians are in favor of, like equality of marriage or the environment or this. So take your ill-gotten tax cuts, which are likely to come out of the recent election of Trump, and don't be afraid to spend the money with some of your favorite causes. If you're unhappy with the social programs that come out of this, feel free to put money into whatever you want. And that rationality, that basis in reality, politics matters much less to markets. Hey, does this affect discounted cash flow? Does this affect profits? Then it's just background noise. It's not relevant. Where we're starting to see the early signs that that might be changing is the trade war and tariffs. And eventually, I think tariffs could, assuming the adults don't get back in charge, it could eventually push through and cause more inflation and cause the Fed to tighten sooner, which leads to crimping of credit, which leads to a recession, which leads to a market correction. That is what I think as a higher probability worst case scenario, as opposed to the terrible black swans, or as opposed to everything's great forever. You know, 2 years out, 3 years out, if we continue to make a number of bad decisions, and I will say the tariffs are really not well thought out, the $12 billion aid, I think exports of, they want to cover 75% of the cost of trade war. Wait, why are taxpayers paying for this? How are we winning if taxpayers are paying for the negative impact of tariffs? This sounds like a terrible idea. And if we keep doing that, it's going to send inflation higher. And if that happens, it's not a good thing. So some people don't like that. Our clients are all self-selecting. Our clients come to us because they more or less agree with us. Half our conversations begin, my guy at fill in the blank is a jerk. You guys seem to be making sense. So if one out of 20 people say, I don't like what you wrote about the president, hey, you should be more concerned with what he's doing to soybean prices because you live in the Midwest than you should be concerned about me complaining about the. By the way, you notice how the Chinese are very, very strategic in how they issue their counter tariffs. It's like, you want to play this game? Fine. We're smarter than you. We're going to mess with your base. Have at it.
Active passive. You said you use active a little bit. We've tended to see in the flows that active fixed income mutual funds are still taking in money. Not a lot, but they're treading water at least. It's active equity that's getting just total bloodbath. Right. Does that align with what you feel with active? Do you go active on the fixed income side? Do you think there's more value add
100%.
There?
100%.
Okay, why?
So, well, the academic data demonstrates that active fixed income is a winner versus passive, because if it's passive, you're buying everything, good, bad, and different. With active, you get to choose your price. You get to choose your duration. You get to choose your quality, even within the same, hey, I want, you know, B++ to and up, and I want 5 to 10 years, and I want this, and I want that. So the data is active fixed income is superior in excess of the cost. So there's that. A year ago, we swapped out a passive bond fund for a active bond fund, and the overlap in holdings was something like 60 or 80%. I'm doing it from memory. But the 20 or 40% that was different, I don't even think it was 40%, I think it was less, was enough to make a big difference in the performance at the same risk level. So the trade-off is you're paying a little more, but you're getting more. So that's worthwhile. Active versus passive, I think, is the wrong way to look at it. It's expensive versus cheap. Morningstar did a study. I want to say it was 2011.
Eric loves that one.
What, the Morningstar study?
No, high cost to low cost.
Yeah, high
to
cost.
To me, that's the big trend. So, but let's go to fixed income active.
Sure.
First of all, do you use the ETF structure or the mutual fund structure?
Mutual fund.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, the holding periods are much longer, so you don't run into the tax situations. And to be honest, a lot of the better mutual fund active, I want to say it, make sure I'm getting this right, active mutual funds don't have a less expensive parallel ETF. If you remember when PIMCO,
right,
which we no longer own, but PIMCO, when they rolled out their ETFs, they were more expensive than the mutual funds.
Right, 55 to 45.
Because they didn't want to see a massive
Correct.
Outflux.
Although it was cheaper than the A class. So if you're a retail, you got a better
right.
deal, right?
Right.
But
so
it was priced right in between the I and the A.
What a
right.
coincidence.
Yeah, right. Gundlach did the same thing.
Yes. Because it makes sense to do that.
When you're choosing a fixed income active fund,
mm-hmm.
I know cost is important for you. How important is cost versus sort of the record of the fund?
So it's a holistic approach. You have to look at everything. My favorite Morningstar research report, and remember, they judge funds on the basis of their star report. If you can only look at one thing when reviewing a mutual fund, says Morningstar, it turns out cost is the most important thing. If you are choosing amongst 5-star funds versus cheapest funds, choosing the cheapest outperform the 5-star approach. I give them credit not only for publishing that, but not taking it down and revisiting it every few years. So cost is really, really important. Over long periods of time, the compounding makes a tremendous difference. There's a Vanguard study about, you know, the average Vanguard, I think it's like 17 basis points or 25, whatever it is. It's some ungodly cheap thing. The typical active mutual fund used to be about 1.25%. Over a 30-year period, it's an immense, it's like 30% difference in total returns compounded over that. It was just massive. So cost matters. I don't care as much about recent performance as I do the process. It has to be defendable. It has to be rational. It has to make sense and hopefully be repeatable. You know, my favorite example in the world of hedge funds is Paulson & Co. So when John Paulson had the greatest trade ever, betting against the mortgage collapse and the subprime and derivative collapse, I think he was like a $5 billion fund or whatever. And following the collapse, he swelled up to $30 or $40 billion and then proceeded to underperform for a good number of years. So it turned out that was a great trade, but it wasn't a repeatable process. We run into the same thing with mutual funds. Hey, there was one mutual fund we had that had a huge amount of mortgages in it and basically was outperforming the comparably risk-based corporates and treasuries post-financial crisis. But at a certain point, mortgage backs in a rising rate environment are not going to do well. So you don't want to sit with that forever. So we ended up rotating out of that to a more focused corporate and investment grade bonds. So you're giving up a little bit of recent performance when you do that, but you're lowering your fees and you're making your prospective gains much better because it's a process that's not dependent on one specific asset class in one specific part of the economic cycle, which is before rates start to rise.
You're an advisor. Mm-hmm. You can see that low cost is sort of sweeping the advisor world, especially because the move to being fiduciaries and getting a fee-based payment model as opposed to a commission.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the institutional world still seems really, really into sort of private equity, hedge funds, hiring and firing external managers right and left.
Uh-huh.
Where do you see that evolving? I think you wrote a column once talking about what pensions should do. Do you see that institutional world evolving more to like sort of your model?
Because it is interesting, like you, especially like endowments. Like in Business Week, we profiled a small college endowment that's been all basically, you know, indexed
for years.
ETFs.
Yeah,
for
that one did
years.
The best or one of the best.
Right. Yeah, outperformed.
I mean, there's
the
always
IDs.
The outlier, like Yale or, you know, they crush it.
But it's
not for a while.
Correct.
But it's a great question, though, of like what happens to institutional money?
Why don't they do that now?
So first of all, let me preface this by explaining how much professionals love unsolicited advice. They love that. Second, you've already seen that begin to take place. Right, there are a number of funds that have been moving, pension funds, endowments, go down the list, have been moving at least part of their asset base. Look at CalPERS, fired all their hedge funds. Took 2 years to unwind that crap, but still, this is not, you know, they are not immune from the same trend that years ago I went to a state pension fund in the tri-state area, their quarterly meeting. I was invited to speak by someone there. And I listened to a parade of a dozen consultants explain why all the crap they're in this year, which hasn't done well, is perfectly positioned to do well next year. And now is not the time to sell this, to sell any of this stuff. And everybody around the table was nodding their head. And I sat there just grinding my molars. And when I got literally the head of the table, a whole giant rectangular place, I said, look, I prepared these really smart, well-thought-out remarks, but it's clear that they will be wasted on you. And I know I'm never going to do business with anyone in this room, so for 5 minutes, let's just pull all the bullshit aside and give you the straight dope. None of these guys here know what the hell they're talking about. They are salesmen, and they are really good at it. Because halfway through their pitches, I'm like, wow, that's great. How do I get into some of that? Oh, wait, they've underperformed every year you've had them for 10 years and charged you a massive amount of money for the privilege? How stupid are you? How could you guys continue giving money to guys who are, they're not just wrong, they're wrong and consistently wrong, and you keep buying the same line of BS every, hey, you know, it's like the, someone's having an affair on their wife and they keep saying to their lover, I'm going to leave her next year. No, next year is when we finally. It's year after year after year. They're telling you the same thing. They're selling you the same bill of goods and it's crap. And I can't believe people in this room with a fiduciary obligation to the pensioners are buying into this. So really, I'm on the wrong side of this business. I shouldn't be telling you about asset management. I should be going to your beneficiaries and saying, let's talk about the subsequent litigation, suing these idiots who have underperformed your portfolio because it keeps them in high-paying board seats. I can't explain why this is going on, but it's apparent that all these promises are nonsense. When are you people going to wake up and realize you're being sold a bill of goods? I'm sorry that's not as entertaining as what I had prepared, but I just can't. I listened to a parade of nonsense, and everybody around the table was nodding their head.
Did they invite you back?
Never.
I wonder why.
Well, it's funny. We had Bogle on. We interviewed him for this separate episode, and he was saying he was upset the ICI would not invite him to speak. And I said, I think what you're saying to these
cowards
people is just too. There's definitely an internal conflict within the industry, and I think even within companies and within people,
mm-hmm.
of this move to lower fee goods.
Right.
But if you're in the financial industry, you're feeding off of the higher cost revenue. And I think as investors and people, practitioners, there's definitely some tension going on that he taps into. That's my theory on why he was not invited, even though he's, you know, clearly warranted to.
No, the only explanation for ICI not inviting him is cowardice. There's no other explanation. Listen, Apple taught us all about cannibalization, which the financial industry has a real hard time with. Apple puts out an iPod for $500, and it has 10 megs. The next year, Apple says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you 30 megs, and it's $400. And the next next year, it's 100 megs, and it's $200. And then it's a gig for $100, and nobody can catch them. That was the iPod, then the iPad, then the iPhone. Could you imagine the average finance company saying, we know this is 1.5% and it's underperformed, but here's what we're going to give you, and now it's 75 basis points. It doesn't happen. To their credit, a handful of companies, I'll include Fidelity in this, I'll include Schwab in this, have lowered fees. State Street, BlackRock have lowered fees on a number of their products. Some companies will choose a loss leader and say, even Goldman Sachs has, a 7 or a 9 basis point fund? Someone will come in and say, we'll lower this. I think the math was that 10 years ago, the cheapest fund in just about every category was 70% of them were Vanguard. Now the cheapest fund in every category, I want to say it's 35 or 40% Vanguard. It's not that they've raised their rates. It's that the Vanguard effect has driven everybody else, if not across the board, at least to pick one or two things and really slash the price on it. So it's very much challenging to get any industry. It's not just finance. Hey, this is your bread and butter. You should cut your fees 50%. And we cut our fees 15%. And when we were debating it, it's like, wow, that's a big chunk of money. What's that going to do to our cash flow? And we're a small, not even 5-year-old company. Imagine you're a 40-year-old company making billions of dollars a year, and some consultant comes in and says, you should slash your fees in half.
Back to the ETF. As an avid user, what limitations do you think they have?
So there's some obvious ones and then some less obvious ones. To me, the most obvious limitation is liquidity. That as you get into some of the backwaters, some of the esoteric ones, they have market caps of $100 or $200 million and they trade by appointment. And that's a little bit of a problem. If the whole idea of ETFs are that they trade not just the tax aspect, but you can trade during the day.
And then they don't trade.
And then so there's no advantage there. So that's number one. Number two.
And just to clarify, there's probably 1,000 ETFs less than 100 million. So that's about half.
Right.
So as an advisor, you just sort of eliminate all those right off the bat.
They become really challenging to work with. I don't want to say we eliminate them, but it's a factor when you're making a decision. Second, the entire process of bringing out an ETF public to that process is wildly complicated, overly expensive. The internal expense ratios that these small fund companies paying, they're pretty outrageous. And so the playing field is not level. There's a huge advantage to the BlackRock, State Streets, Vanguards, et cetera. I want to say the top three or top four are something like 70% of the AUM. It's some ungodly.
The top three.
Top three of 70% of the AUM.
Yeah.
So if we want innovation, if we want creativity, if we want to try a bunch of things, throw it against the wall, and see what sticks as an industry, I think the SEC needs to make that process a little less expensive, a little more streamlined. I had a front row.
Well, they are, right? The ETF rule will do pretty much that. Yeah.
So now, on the other hand, we don't want a million fly-by-night BS ETFs, but it shouldn't be an impediment to a small firm with a good idea shouldn't say, I can't do this because it's going to cost me $1 million.
What would be your good idea if you launched one?
For an ETF? I don't think there's a factor-based ESG ETF out there, at least when you and I had a conversation about this last summer.
Yeah.
When I looked at it, I could not find a factor-based ESG ETF. I thought that was interesting.
Well, the problem with that, ESG isn't selling. And factors are 700 of them, or 700 smart beta.
Right.
And you talked about not being sort
of— The top
of
10, though, is all you
weren't
need.
You weren't moved so much by factor ETFs. Would you be moved by a factor ESG?
No, that's what I mean. There should be a factor-based ESG ETF. But, you know, by the time this broadcast, there will be one. But when we first spoke about it, we didn't.
Filing right here, I see
it. And here's the thing about ESG. People have said, well, there's not a lot of motion towards that. When you look at the people who say they're interested in ESG investing, environmental, social, and governance investing, they tend to be millennials and they tend to be women. And we are on the leading edge of a, make up a number, $30-plus trillion generational wealth transfer from the boomers to the Xers and the millennials, who consist of, it'll go to the wife and then it'll go to the kids, typically. And that's the people who say they're interested in ESG. So I think it's early to write off ESG. You disagree.
I do. And here's why. You talk about boomers, right?
Uh-huh.
Nobody was more progressive than they were in the 60s. No, why aren't they into ESG?
No, it's the worst generation ever.
Oh, come on. They were all into this. Look,
hate
I remember
them.
Michael Stipe had the acid rain hat. We were all into it too,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Stipe isn't a boomer.
But no, I'm saying every generation is into it when they're young. It seems to me there's
maybe,
also probably
maybe.
I don't want to say you get corrupt or you just stop caring, but like, right. Is it possible?
Got to take the kids to soccer.
Yeah.
The electrician's coming by
yeah.
to fix that. You get busy.
Yeah. So is it not millennials are into it now? It's just whoever's young is into it and then they get out
That's
of it.
That's a good theory. I think that in the 60s, climate change was a very abstract, theoretical concept. Other than a handful of flat earthers, everybody now knows that climate change is real. It's like I wouldn't buy a place in on the coast in Florida now. I would rent because that's going to be underwater soon. Now, it might be 100 years. It might be 50 years. Unless technology comes along with a magic little thing and sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, if we eventually come up with a way to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and to reduce the greenhouse effect, then all the worst-case scenarios don't come to fruition. And I really hope technology solves that. However, right now, it looks like this is going to be an issue that the next few generations are going to have to wrestle with long after we shuffle off this mortal coil. So I think this generation is more serious about it than the boomers, the worst generation, were in the 60s. By the way, everything bad in the world you can blame on the boomers. All the debt is blamed on the boomers.
The music was good.
STDs, I'll give you that.
Okay.
But STDs,
and the movies.
You can blame on the boomers. The movies in the 60s, with a handful of exceptions,
the
were
Graduate?
Unwatchable. Graduate is much later than that.
Apocalypse Now. The 70s was really the golden
yes,
era.
Yes, Apocalypse.
Right?
Right. So my movie watching is 30s and 40s, 50s. The 60s is a. There are some good movies, but it's a. So I blame most of bad things that happen on the baby boomers, of which I don't consider myself. I'm in the valley between the Xers and the boomers.
So that's it for episode one. But we're not done talking with Barry Ritholtz. To keep listening, though, you'll have to go back to your favorite podcast app and find episode 2.